Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on the program today. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. The radio show's page is available for the archives. And so we encourage you to check out our guests and their websites because we link to them. And so you can check out all the good information that's available from them as well as from our guest today, Richard House, Dr. Richard House. He's written a book called Between Now and When, How My Death Made My Life Worth Living. And I remember interviewing Ed Geron not too long ago, a local a host of a program here on this station. He's an actor he's a horseman and so forth. And he had described as his near-death experience. And I described that as Ed died and lived to tell about it. Well, Dr. Richard House, in the same contents, also died and lived to tell about it. And, Doctor, welcome to our program. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is an extraordinary true story. I cannot imagine anybody lying about it. I don't know why anybody would. There isn't any kind of financial reservoir that one taps into when one has a near-death experience. And of course, we've been dealing with this subject of death and dying as well as out-of-body experiences, which is what a near-death experience is also, but obviously more than just that. And so we're going to get into that as well. What is your area, your medical area of expertise, by the way?
Well, I did ear, nose, and throat for about 15 years. And for the past 24 years, I've been doing medical acupuncture and esoteric healing.
Esoteric healing. Can you define that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. I work through the chakra system.
Okay.
Which is more available when you use the acupuncture meridians in combination with them.
Now, you also, and this is part of your near-death experience, and I'm actually going to let you describe the events leading up to it, but I'm curious from your standpoint prior to this experience, how aware were you of near-death experiences of others? Had you read much or been in contact with any people?
Well, it would have been helpful, I have to admit that, but no, I had absolutely no idea that such things could happen.
Really? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know that I have not had either the OBE or the NDE, as it were, experiences, so I'm not able to, address those in that context. But I've talked with some people who, one gentleman in particular, who actually, not the near-death, but the out-of-body, actually he induces them and on a regular basis. And what was extraordinary from my standpoint was the fact that this gentleman was a professing Christian, a Bible-believing Christian, had all the basic fundamental beliefs and all of that, and yet here he was. And I actually challenged him ever so slightly, not to want to offend, as, you know, I don't read anywhere where this is an experience that people of this belief are supposed to be participating in, although I haven't read anywhere also where you're prohibited from doing these kinds of things. And of course, he had no problem with it. But when you had your experience, just getting into that aspect of it, was there any moment in it where you actually maybe had a thought of, you know, I kind of like it here. I'm going to stay.
Yeah, well, you hit it right on the head. Yeah, in the midst of it. If someone had asked me whether I wanted to go back or to continue this death experience, I would have said, hands down, let's keep right on going. This is wonderful.
So the process, we'll get into the details as well, but I'm just curious as to the events that led up to this. How did you wind up dying?
Good question. I think probably the easiest way for presenting this is going back to when I was 7 years old. I was standing underneath a very tall cedar tree when all of a sudden I had an experience of oneness with everything that there is. The Buddhists sometimes call this Satori, and it was a magnificent experience where I was not a kid at all, but the vast everything of the universe and beyond. But of course, as a kid, I really didn't know what to do with that. And when the experience passed, I thought, wow, what do I do? You know, I had this feeling that I was both, that I was a 7-year-old kid and I was something much, much bigger than that. And so actually what happened, Richard, is I tried to find a sort of a name for that that took into account my being a kid and also being this vast thing. And I came up with this name, which was Ichen, I-C-H-E-N. And I started calling myself that. And of course, my mom, who's a very educated woman, and she said, What is this? No, your name is Richard. We share the same name. So I reverted to Richard and was pretty much a normal kid from that point forward. But when I was between 12 and 13 years old, I had another very unusual experience. I was sort of minding my own business. Actually, I was drawing a picture of a Christian cross, which is sort of interesting. But during that, when my mind was absorbed with that, and all of a sudden, I had this sort of message come into my mind, sort of like email going straight to your brain. So I guess we could call it brain mail. And this message I knew very clearly was from God, and it said, "You will die at the age of 33," and that was the end of it.
So yeah. what was your religious upbringing, and did you make any kind of connection in that regard?
Well, you know, my folks were Presbyterian at the time, as I recall, and I did not have much of a religious bent. I'll have to say that, because the reason was that I had connected with something much larger than religion, in my view, and so I didn't have this need. I felt complete. And so when this message came, and I knew it was definitely from God, I kind of thought, well, that's kind of alarming. But at the same time, I didn't question it, and it didn't upset me much. I just said, oh, well, in that case, all right. And I picked up my skateboard and started, you know, just being a kid again.
And now, at the prior to your incident at the age of 33, which I'm guessing this prediction was accurate.
It proved to be, yes.
Prior to that, I mean, as an adult, obviously you had heard all of the, you know, the biblical stories, and there's a song I recall by one of my favorite artists. The lyrics go something along the lines of, "Today is my birthday, and now I'm 33. It's the day that Mozart died, and Jesus, sweet Jesus, was set free." And obviously, it was the same day that, the same age that you died. Did you make any correlation in that regard? I mean, or not, because you didn't have that kind of background spiritually or religiously?
It did occur to me, but it wasn't then. I had not really paid much attention to the Bible or anything, but after that message, I did start reading the New Testament, and I came across that fact that he was 33, and I thought, well, how about that? Yeah. I wasn't sure how it connected with me, but it was there. Yeah, I did notice.
I mean, it's quite interesting, because for myself, I had what I might call a cathartic experience at the age of 33. I mean, I remember it to this day, and I remember sharing at the dinner table with my parents, one of these experiences that I'd had. on this trip that I went on with some buddies of mine, where I said, yeah, it's interesting how I feel as though I really became a man, you know, on this trip, you know, through this experience, to which my mother said, well, it's about time. For me, that was an interesting turning point, you know, even if it was just at that moment where I actually could say, yeah, I stood up, I stood my ground, I didn't harm anyone or put anyone in jeopardy, or let alone myself, but I was able to walk away saying, yeah, I'm okay with the outcome of this, you know, because I did what I needed to do, and that's what men do. Children run away, children cower, children are in fear, but adults, you know, when you're dealing with other adults, you don't have to do that. And so I find that rather extraordinary from that standpoint, that year for a lot of people, that age, I should say, 33, I don't know where, I haven't really researched the numerological aspects or attributes of it, but I'm sure that someone has done a great deal of study on it and would have to check into that. As far as getting into that state, the near-death experience, you were dealing with a particular addiction or addictions.
Well, actually, what happened was I was a good student, and so I was admitted to Butler University after high school, which is a fine school in Indianapolis. And there I learned two things. I learned how to drink, and I learned about romantic love.
Ah.
And those two things were far more interesting to me than English 101, I'll have to tell you.
Well, I'll have to remember that next time I want to go back to college.
But it was my association with my friend Jack Daniels that really led me to that next experience at the age of 33.
Mm. And share with us, if you can, share with us the experience that you went through. Obviously, you were, obviously imbibing heavily, to obviously a critical degree. Can you define at what moment you became aware that you weren't where you were supposed to be anymore?
Yes, actually, there was a defining moment. But what happened was I got my medical training, and I was very good at it. I was very good at being a doctor and a surgeon. And so I had a wife and was making good money and child and drove nice cars, all that sort of thing. But as the addictive demon started taking over, I got sicker and sicker, and pretty soon I got to the point where I didn't really think I should work anymore. And so I was sitting out on my deck, and I looked down at my swollen belly, and I saw this little red dot, and what it was a spider hemangioma, is the technical word. And I had seen a number of these little babies on patients on the cirrhosis ward. And so when I looked down at that belly, I thought, wow, I've got cirrhosis. Now, that was an amazing thing. So you know what I did is I took my T-shirt and put it on and covered it up. And I said, well, that takes care of that.
Mm-hmm. Solves the problem.
Solves the problem. It wasn't long after that, Richard, that I got so sick that I started vomiting blood. And at that juncture, I knew that the game was probably up. And sure enough, I was 33 years old. And so they scooted me to the hospital, and I was in the ICU. And the doctor came, and he was sort of a casual friend of mine. And he said, Say, Richard, he says, do you drink? I said, a little bit here and there, yeah. And he said, well, I've got some tough news for you. He said, your liver is shot, and you've got bleeding esophageal varices. Now, any doctors that might be listening will know that that is a death sentence. And as soon as he said that, I knew that it was. There really is no remedy for that. He had been, or the doctor had been giving me transfusions for the blood loss, and I had 18 of them. And so after we had a little conference, he said, well, I don't really don't see much point in giving you any more blood. We just put it in one tube and it comes out the other. He said, why don't you just say your goodbyes and we'll let you go. And I thought, wow, that sounds great, because I had so much suffering, so much pain, and I felt so guilty about what had transpired that I thought, well, that sounds just perfect. So that's what we did. I said goodbye and all that. And then at about 2 or 3 in the morning, I felt something that was really extraordinary. And what it was a sensation of comfort. And I think that it was the first time in my entire life I had been comfortable. And it felt so good. I thought, whew. And so that's when the near-death experience began. What happened after that is, as you probably heard before, I drifted away from my body, what you would call the out-of-body thing. And I was able to look at it and look at myself there. And I was just as yellow as a banana. Wow. And with that jaundice and all. Sorry, sick person. And but as my experience was so different, because the comfort started segueing into something that is indescribable, but you can call it bliss. And as I said a little bit before, it was so wonderful that I wanted to keep right on going. And I felt like I was flying and that I was being held in the arms of God. And it was like this incredible love is what I felt. And it was so different than anything that I'd ever experienced. And then what happened was that I had another one of these messages, these messages that came in. And this time the message said, you're going to heal and work for me. And when I heard those words, I thought, oh, okay. And I think if I could have, I would have saluted and said, yes, sir. It was that kind of feeling. There was no question, even though I was so comfortable and feeling this bliss. I said, okay, I'll do that. And that was pretty much what happened after that. I drifted back into my body, and but I knew that when I entered that body again, that I had been healed in some mysterious, magical way. And that proves to be the case. My bleeding stopped, and my lab stuff started getting better, and 2 or 3 days later, I was out of the hospital. It was absolutely remarkable. And, of course, the doctors were pretty amazed about it. I guess I was, too.
Quite extraordinary, to say the very least, but I think we could probably put that under the category of a miracle nonetheless, especially considering, and I'm curious as to if you have ever had time to reflect on the reasons why you felt the need to become such close and intimate friends with Jack that led you on this path, because I sometimes wonder, I realize this is a stretch for some folks, but I sometimes wonder if the only way for us to get the message we need is that we have to. It's almost like you want enlightenment, you got to go down that dark alley. You have no choice but to go down that dark alley, or you can spend 5 or 6 or 7 lifetimes. Your choice.
Boy, did you say that right. That's precisely the way I see it. And for some people, like me, it was addiction. Mm-hmm. But for other people, it may be other insurmountable problems that we have to deal with. Some form of suffering. Mm-hmm. And it at a very special time in your long, long journey, these things are presented. And what happens is that you have to surrender. It forces you down on your knees, and you say, oh, my, I can't. And that's when God, or whatever you want to call it, It comes in and lifts you up and says, all right, now come walk with me. That's the way I see it, just like you said.
So after this experience, you're out of the hospital after 3 days. You are ostensibly not on the mend. You are mended. You are healed. What was your next course of action, as it were, as you saw it, thinking, okay, well, you know, I beat the Grim Reaper this time, or those wonderful insights and awarenesses led you traveling?
Yeah, what happened, and I think this is an important facet. I kind of jump ahead a little bit. I go into some of the details in the book, but I felt like I was sort of in between two different states. And that's where the title of the book comes from, Between Now and When. The now, of course, is, you know, our everyday experience, that we have to wake up to. But the when part was this, higher dimensional experience. That is absolutely amazing. And that's where I started going after this whole experience. Now, what happened was I spent a year or two sort of getting my feet on the ground again and getting my practice back together and family and all that. And there was quite a lot of drama, as you might expect. And but about a year later, I was sitting in my empty house that was up for sale on the couch, and I was looking down at the floor, and the floor tiles all of a sudden became luminescent with this incredible beauty that was absolutely astounding. And as I'm looking at these tiles, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? How can these floor tiles be so beautiful? And, of course, the experience only lasted for a few moments, but it was my very first introduction into what I call the beautiful land or the magical land or the land of subtle beauty. You can call it whatever you like, but it's what underlies this reality. And so I got a peek into it. Hmm.
When we come back, we're going to talk further with Dr. Richard House. He has a book entitled Between Now and When, How My Death Made My Life Worth Living, A True Story. You can also go to richardhousemd.com and find out more about him, the work that he's doing, and so forth. And we will talk more with Dr. House in just a moment here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. My guest is Richard House, Dr. Richard House. He has a book out called Between Now and When, and we're talking about his experiences, his near-death experiences, which this month is what we're focusing on here in the month of September, as we talk with the various different people about their experiences and the things that they are here to share with us. Now, I'm curious, a lot of folks, when they have these kind of experiences, in addition to wonderful individual profound insights and awarenesses, sometimes people will come back with messages for the world or for other individuals. Did anything like that happen with you?
Absolutely. And that was sort of where I was going with this magical land. Because what happened after that is that I started entering that beautiful place more and more. And I would spend even up to an hour or two. And the way it feels is where you're looking out at the leaves on the tree and in the sidewalk as you're walking along, all of a sudden it's just filled with this incredible beauty and this sound that just makes your heart sing. And the most amazing part of that different consciousness is that there's no fear and there's no worry. You know, when I was in those states, I could think of all the things that were causing trouble, like not enough money or, you know, relationship problems. But there was no emotion connected with it. And it was this complete feeling of freedom. And as wonderful as those experiences were, they weren't addictive. They weren't like my old buddy Jack Daniels. I spent time in those states for a period of a year or so, but it was like an introduction. It was like, see what's here? Now, the message that I really have to give to folks is that we are in between, and this is another reason the book is called that, we are in between ages now. In the East, what we have been through is called the Age of Kali, or sometimes called the Age of Pisces, as you probably know. And what we're headed for is the Age of Aquarius. Now, when that manifests, these states that I'm talking about will be the normal states for everyone. And there are a few of us now that have been introduced to it, and we do what we can with energetic work in the higher dimensions to make all this happen for everyone. So I guess that's my primary message.
Are you able to, even in this day, to this day, are you able to return to these states at all?
It's been a long time since I had the profound experience, and I'm here to tell you, I do miss it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very rarely. It's sort of like God says, hey, listen, don't forget about this. But it's rare. And the reason is, like 2 days ago, I saw 14 patients in the office. And earlier today, I cleaned out the goat barn. Those kinds of things. You can't do that if you're walking around in the beautiful land. And so in a sense, after a year or two of that, I had to get my feet back on the ground so I could pay attention to the details that confront all of us.
Hmm. In terms of the people around you before and after, did you manage to retain many of the relationships and associations, or did many of them fall away because of the experiences that you were then having?
That's a great question. Right after I got out of the hospital, my wife and I had to divorce because she fell in love with someone else. And yet today she's just as dear to me as she was then. And we get to meet frequently. And so the short answer is that I don't believe anyone fell by the wayside. They're all very dear to me even to this day. And so I do have, of course, many, many friends, and I've seen thousands and thousands of patients in the office. And it's my great blessing that I'm able to help them in ways that are a little bit on the extraordinary side.
Well, I know that it does tend to happen from time to time that when people have these experiences and they're opened up to new awarenesses, both of themselves and the rest of the world and the universe, especially on a more esoteric or spiritual level, that some folks tend to drift away going, this is not for me, or they're a little too far out, or whatever the case might be. And sometimes that's extremely appropriate because you want to try, if you can, to surround yourself with people who will, if not support you, at least not belittle your experience. And that's a big concern that I have had over the years with people who have had a myriad of different types of experiences, including near death, within particular belief systems. Because this, they'll get criticized saying, oh, no, there's nowhere in our writings that says you can do that or this or the other thing. Well, what are you supposed to do with the experience now? That's part of you. You're supposed to write it off and it never happened? Because it's going to come back on you eventually.
Well, I think you're right about that. And for the folks that have that experience, what it means is that the beauties that have been opened internally are not to be expressed on this level, but they're still there. And you might be working on a higher level with what your consciousness is now experiencing. And as a matter of fact, to make my answer a little more complete, after I traveled around the world and three times, as it turns out, and did a lot of higher dimensional work, which I go into in the book, what I did is clamped it all down because I had done that phase, and so I had to get back into ordinary life, or else I think my body would have probably failed, because you can't do that higher stuff, that energetic stuff, without paying a price physically. So for about 30 years, I basically just covered it all up, and no one knew anything about it. In fact, a lot of the people that read this book say, really? We had absolutely no idea, because I've kept it secret.
Ah, okay. and for that very reason?
Yes.
Interesting. But now they know, because you've written this book.
Yeah, and it's a little scary, to tell you the truth.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, so this is I'm entering a new phase where I'm wide open again. And so I'm starting my travels again. And I visited all the states, and I do interdimensional work when I'm there. But mostly it's solo work. It doesn't involve other people. I don't give talks or seminars or any of that. And I certainly don't do anything to make money from it. Fortunately, God has blessed me with the ability to make money doing doctor-type stuff. And so now I'm starting to open up a bit, and I'll be traveling again around the United States doing this work, and then overseas.
And how are you received in other parts of both this country as well as around the world as you travel?
I pretty much stay to myself, and so it's not much of an issue.
Okay.
But,
so you're just traveling, so to speak, incognito
yes.
as a solo traveler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are places that are energetically active, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the places that that's why I was on islands for the most part, because they have the most subtle energy available.
Is that because they're surrounded by water so tightly in that regard?
Well, actually it is. The water is second chakra stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the subtle energy is more available where there is a great deal of water. And, of course, you can't be on the water, at least not me. I get seasick. So I found that islands, in fact, as a matter of fact, I think that is a fairly generalized feeling among esoteric healers, that the energy on islands is easier to access. And that's what happened in England, if you think about it. That's an island, too. And they still have a huge tradition of the little people, and the leprechauns and all that. And so I think that's why.
Well, I tell you, maybe that's the part of the big draw that my wife and I have to Ireland, which is a much larger island than most, but nonetheless, and also because of the folk tales and the stories that are told of that, as well as what always intrigues me is the more esoteric aspect, especially when you start talking about the medicine people, if you will, not the doctors, but we're talking now about those who use the plants and different things on the land for medicinal purposes that are not harmful. I mean, we were just listening to a report on NPR today, for example, about this particular plant that this particular company wants to synthesize. And my wife is sitting there as we're driving, talking to the radio, saying, why don't you just use the whole plant? Why do you have to synthesize it? And yet at the same time, I wonder, in your more esoteric or spiritual experiences, if you see us coming to a place and reaching a level where we will be able to learn how to change the energetics within our bodies to, stave off or rid ourselves of the various diseases and maladies that afflict us today.
Oh, yes. That's where we're headed. Technology is about to hit a dead end.
It's peaked.
And so what's going to happen afterwards is we're going to get connected up with the earth, that beautiful land that I was telling you about,
mm-hmm.
and the little people that inhabit it. As a matter of fact, I just finished writing a novel that is about that very thing. And it's about sort of after the end of this era mm-hmm. and the beginning of the next age, where we do have connections with the little people. The leprechauns of Ireland, for instance.
Yes.
And the divas that helped Findhorn become a successful place in a barren desert, and so on. And as a result of the essence of the subtle world, illness is no longer a huge factor like it is now. The illnesses that we experience now are the result of karmic sort of interactions that are very negative. And, you know, all the viruses came from domesticated animals. Did you know that?
The iris?
All the viruses.
Oh, viruses. I was not aware of that.
Yeah, all the viruses that infect humans came from confined animals, the beginning of about 11,000 B.C., and as we kept animals, the viruses learned how to jump into the human form. And so it is a form of sort of karmic repay for the terrible way that we have treated animals. And not that I'm a big PETA person or anything. I'm just telling you the way I see it.
Right. Well, I know that there's a great deal that we still have to learn about this planet, and some of us have learned it and are trying to live by what we've learned and show respect for both the land as well as the animals that dwell on it. And it's trying to convince in a non-violent way the others who haven't seen that yet that this is really critical. My wife is more into these television programs than I am, but you know, we're watching some programs where, you know, the animals are now starting to sort of attack and be predators to humans. So it's just really interesting that you kind of bring that up.
Yeah, and it'll get worse and worse as time goes on. And I don't think we are going to learn this lesson. What'll happen is that it will be slapped in the face with an end to the whole thing. And of course, this is part of it. And as you're well aware, that there is some sort of apocalypse that will have to end this age. But I don't focus on that much because certainly we do have to have the phoenix rise from the ashes. But what I prefer to think about is what's coming afterwards. And that was why I mentioned all that business about the beautiful land, because it is beautiful, and that is what's going to happen. And so if we focus on that, then it's much better than focusing on the end.
Dr. Richard House is my guest, and he is sharing with us about his work and his experiences, and he's put those into a book called Between Now and When, How My Death Made My Life Worth Living, A True Story. You can go to richardhousemd.com to find out more. There's some videos there and some other links, and I think that it would behoove folks to definitely investigate it. It can only help. It can only help. Tell me a little bit about where you are today. Now, obviously, you're still practicing. As you mentioned, that you've seen a number of patients already today. But in terms of this experience, how it has changed you and how you have managed to, granted you say you can't stay in those states that you were in for the 2 years prior, just simply because it's kind of like, the molecular cohesion kind of dissipates because you don't have that same, I'll call it denser energy that is needed to hold the body together. But how do you sort of fortify yourself in terms of that experience where you said, hey, this is really cool, I think I want to stay here, where you can kind of visit it from time to time, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I will tell you, but I don't necessarily recommend this for other folks, but it requires a great deal of discipline in order to maintain one's feet on the ground and still work in higher dimensions without having your physicality dissolve. Now, for me, that has meant being basically a recluse, and this is a fairly common story. you know, although I have a busy practice and all that, I really do. I live in a very small place that I built myself. It's 500 square feet. And I get up at 3:30 every morning and begin the day with a meditation and yoga. And then end the day that way, too, at about 7:30. And I'll tell you, if you go to bed at 7:30, there's not much social life. Do you know what I mean?
I do, yes. Absolutely.
So, and then, of course, I'm vegetarian and just eat twice a day, those kinds of things. So, as I say, I really can't recommend this. I have a lot of love relationships, and in fact, my kids live close by, and I have grandkids and visit with them, but just for short periods of time, because I, in order to do this other work that is really what my life is all about, I have to really limit what most people would call ordinary life. And that's what all of us do that are working on this level. You're not going to find a lot of extroverts who are party guys or going to football games and all doing the type of work that I do.
Well, I have to say that I'm not I don't know if it's because I'm getting older or what have you, but I'm not really into to big crowds anymore. I used to love going when I lived in Phoenix, loved going to the mall at Christmas time and sort of wading through all of the people and, you know, seeing how quickly I could weave my way down the mall floor from one end to the other kind of thing. There was sort of a challenge there. But now I don't want anybody in front of me. I don't want anybody behind me. You know,
yeah,
because I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, also their energy affects you.
Yeah.
You know, we are energetic beings, even though most people don't recognize that. And every time we have a contact with someone, in fact, this is well documented, you know, that person will either enhance your own energy or steal it. And so even casual contacts like that can affect people that are working on energetic levels. And so I'm sure that that's part of what's going on with you. You know, you get somebody else go to the mall.
You know, yeah, really, exactly. Or I'll just buy it online. I'll go to the virtual mall, as it were. and yet at the same time, moving to Santa Barbara as we did was quite exciting because I'm within walking distance of the beach where I've wanted to live close to for decades. Finally made it and have lived here almost a decade, and now we both find ourselves sort of turning to the universe and saying, okay, what's next? We're ready for the next adventure, you know, and make it a good one, make it one that we can share with others, that allows us to continue to prosper and build on what we've created thus far, and so on and so forth. A lot of folks, unfortunately, they tend to have adventures that seem to diminish their worldly possessions or even their jobs and their livelihood and all of these kinds of things, to where now, you know, they're sort of stuck. They feel that way anyway. And it's years later that they'll come out and all of a sudden, gee, they've written a book and they've had this experience and they're sharing it. And it's like I was saying earlier, you know, I'd love to not have to go down that dark alley, but, you know, maybe that's what has to happen for some in order to reach that state.
Well, you're right. And look at what the valuable contribution that you are making, because literally thousands of people are hearing things that they're not likely to find on TV. They're hearing about stuff that's going on that is so important. And, of course, everyone that listens to this sort of thing needs to examine their life and say, well, you know, maybe I am missing the boat. Maybe I should be doing something more. And that question is presented to me fairly often. And what I tell folks is that the way to help this new age get settled in is to do the best you can with your own circumstances. Not everyone can travel the world like I did, and not everyone has the talent to be on the radio like you are. But everyone does have the ability to transcend their lower self, their selfishness, the greed, the anger, and so on, and to live a more virtuous life. And it doesn't matter what religious path you're on. The teaching is always the same.
Hmm. Well, to me, it's not an easy road to acknowledge it, honestly. I mean, you know, we all want to be happy and joyous and thrive in our lives, and certainly that's what we're working toward. But you know, again, you know, there we have both dark sides and light sides to us as individuals. They talk about the dark night of the soul or the shadows and so forth. Well, you know, that's part of who we are. Well, and our lives kind of encompass that as well. And I see that less as dualism and more looking at it in a composite as it's just the way that it is.
Oh, you're so right. The way I put it is that non-virtues are the pathway to the virtues.
Mm.
I mean, how can we experience knowledge without having ignorance first? You can't.
Mm.
So ignorance is the pathway to knowledge. And so if you look at somebody and they're working on a different level than you are, and you say, well, look at that stupid person, that's an incorrect way to look at it. Because what they are simply doing is traveling on the path of ignorance to eventually get to knowledge. And you can say that same thing about all the non-virtues. Jealousy is the pathway to love. And hate is the pathway to love. You know, these are the way this, and that's why we have a lower self and a higher self. And so everyone does. Every saint has a lower self. But it doesn't mean that they live through the lower self. It means that they have transcended that and their higher self is more powerful, and that is the pilot.
Hmm. That's very well put, very well put. The book is entitled Between Now and When, How My Death Made My Life Worth Living, A True Story. Dr. Richard House is my guest, and we're discussing a lot of different things, especially in light of his experiences. And basically, this work will basically take you on, I love this, a metaphysical journey around the world. It'll open your eyes to the energetic grid that organizes earthly life. It'll help you to understand human suffering and why it is an important part of God's life on earth, and open your heart to the unlimited power of divine and human love. You know, that third one there about acknowledge, helping you to understand the suffering. Somebody said to me not long ago, and we've sort of elucidated this, I think, quite well already, but we just finished watching the cable series about Henry VIII, the Tudors. And it was only in his last year or so, if that, even that long, that he began to realize what was really important. But in order for him to get there, he had to go through those brutal years. Not brutal for him, but his brutality on the royals and the peasants and all the people within his realm, as well as those, you know, countries that he would go to conquer. And someone said to me not long ago that people who are doing what we judge as, and this was the way they put it, what we judge as evil things are doing nothing more than playing the role that they came here to play.
Hooray. I'm so glad you said that.
And a lot of folks would be listening to us saying, are you kidding me? That person was evil. That devil incarnate. How can you even say that all they were doing? What about the people, all the people that they killed? Well, the irony is that all of the people associated with that person were doing exactly the same thing. And the conclusion of the conversation I had with this person was, and the reason was to bring to light the necessity for living differently. I mean, it seems sort of counterintuitive, but if you, it's been said that if you don't know sadness, how would you know happiness if it hits you in the face? To use a simplistic metaphor.
Wow. Well, you're on the same page that I am, man. That is exactly the way I see things. And so there really are no villains. There are people that play a villainous role.
Mm-hmm.
And so and sometimes there's enormous suffering that comes through them. But the suffering is the vehicle to the opposite. And so we live in duality where all these opposites are. And so as long as we are in this age, we will have evil. But when we get to the next age, the oscillation between the opposites takes an entirely different form. And so right now, there's a tremendous polarity. In other words, we have reached the end of one pair of opposites almost everywhere. You know, the brutality of ISIS and the extreme Muslim sort of behavior is absolutely awful. And yet it is what is necessary so that we can see the opposite manifest later.
But if you compare that, of course, to the awfulness of the 1500s and the Inquisition, I mean, to me, there really isn't much difference.
You're right.
When you look at it from that standpoint.
Well, the Inquisition, all of these things,
yeah.
You know, the Holocaust, they're all a part of our story.
Yeah.
And they're a necessary part of the story. And when you start talking like that, then people start walking away from you because
yeah.
It's so hard to get that, that these things are necessary parts of our human experience and that God is involved in all of this in some strange way. You know, some theologians will say, oh, yeah, well, God's not paying attention. Well, that's absolutely nuts. This is all part of God's great game on earth.
Yeah. So when you look at the big picture, as we've sort of been discussing, your personal, shall we say, remedy, or at least, I don't want to use the word tranquilizer, but say soother for those who tend to really get, you know, wound up in all of this and stress themselves out, which does harm to the body and so forth. What are your recommendations, either as an MD or just as Richard House?
Well, the thing that causes all this suffering and for us to get wound up are desires, frustrated desires. And so if we can step aside from that and keep it simple, stupid, then there's not nearly as much suffering. Once we have our focus more inward instead of outward and what kind of car we have and where our job is and who we're living with and all that, and we start looking inside and saying, what's here? Then we start to calm down.
Mm.
And then if you start doing, I'm a big believer in exercise, by the way. you know, I walk at least a mile every day and go to the gym a couple times a week. Excuse me. And so those are the ways that we can sort of deal with what's going on.
Well, before we wrap up the program, I do want to thank you for sharing this hour with us. This has been a great deal of fun and very enlightening in that regard, and we encourage people to pick up a copy of Between Now and When. Dr. Richard House, my guest, Dr. Richard House, or actually it's Richard House MD, that's the website, richardhousemd.com, where you can find out more about the work that he is doing. I have a few final questions for you as we wrap up our program.
Sure.
Who is Richard House?
Boy, that's a tough one to answer. I think we're all very complicated souls, and it's hard to put a label on anything. I don't claim to be anything more than someone who has been enlisted in this gigantic, wonderful game of God's life on earth. And so I am a surrendered soul, if you want to put it bluntly. And so when I think of my life, I think of it in terms of what's put before me to do, and I simply do it. So I don't make any claims at all, because just as soon as I make a claim, then you will find some reason to not believe it. And then it puts distance between you and me. So I don't make any claims at all. And if you meet me on the street or in Walmart, you would agree with me.
Well, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Oh, what I want to see is humanity rising up. There are enough of us that have transcended that evil and are living out of our higher self. There's a network of people all over the world that are doing the same kind of stuff that I'm doing and that you're doing. And so I want to see more of that. I want to see love start manifesting. And if it's a small group, it's a very powerful force. And so it doesn't even have to be a majority. It can be a very small minority. But if we live our lives on a daily basis, living through our higher selves and expressing love in our relationships with everyone, absolutely astounding things can happen. So that's what I'd like to see.
And finally, who inspires you?
Well, you do at the moment. I think that I'm inspired by the people that I live with and the people that I see every day in my practice because, you know, all of us are trying hard with what we've got. You know, I don't see people that are simply wallowing in disease or difficult circumstances without trying to get out of it. And so I take my hat off to almost everyone that I meet. And if you have that attitude, then of course you can really help them too to achieve a little better life.
Well, Richard House, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your story with us and the insights through your book Between Now and When. And if you ever find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Well, that sounds real good, Richard. I'll keep that in mind.
I'm Richard Dugan, and we've been talking with Dr. Richard House, the author of Between Now and When, How My Death Made My Life Worth Living. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.